PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert. Sharon Gilbert is on assignment tonight looking for a new secure location for the bunker somewhere in the heart of America, somewhere in mid-Missouri, and she has vowed to remain on this task until she locates a new location, a secure location, of course, one which we will have to conceal from you as soon as it's as soon as we find out what it is. In any case, you're stuck with me for the next 60 minutes or so as we review the news of the day and bring you the final part of our three-part interview with Jerry E. Smith, the author of HARP, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy. So tonight, I launch into this alone, even though Sharon not only is half my heart, well, all of my heart, actually. She's got half my brain with her as well. So I'm working a little shorthanded tonight, and I hope you'll give me a little latitude as we go through the events of the day. Even without her here, there is plenty to talk about, and so let's dive right in. Breaking news, just as we go to press tonight at about 8:30 bunker savings time, seven men in Miami have been arrested, and we are told by federal authorities that they are in custody now because they were in the early stages of a plot to attack Chicago's Sears Tower and other buildings in the United States. Federal law enforcement agencies and local law enforcement in Miami were involved in this arrest. The U.S. Attorney Alexander Acosta in Miami said in a statement that the investigation was still ongoing and that there will be a press conference tomorrow. Local media in the area reporting that federal agents were raiding a warehouse in the Liberty City section of Miami. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez is scheduled to hold a news conference on Friday to discuss the raid, and a simultaneous news conference will be held in Miami at that time. The interesting thing that comes out of this story, at least to my eye and ear, is the phrase homegrown terrorist. The Associated Press has been told that the alleged plotters were mainly Americans with no apparent ties to Al-Qaeda or other foreign terrorist organizations. Now, this is similar to what we heard from Toronto about the 17 young men who were arrested there. No apparent ties to Al-Qaeda, but were inspired by Al-Qaeda. I guess in the sense that a Beatles tribute band is inspired by the Beatles, I guess. They were acting in accordance with what they felt Al-Qaeda would have done, I guess, were they actually in a position to carry out a similar raid. We don't know the details, though. We'll find out more tomorrow. And, you know, again, lest you think I'm making light of the situation, I am not. I certainly hope that this is exactly what we are told it is, a fine example of police work nipping a plot to hurt a lot of innocent people in the bud. But remember the phrase homegrown terrorists, because I predict that we are going to hear that used more and more often in the weeks and months to come. In Washington, D.C. today, the 4,000 government officials who were participating in a continuity of government exercise have emerged from underground. They have been released from their bunkers and are now back home with their families as of this hour. The military analyst for the Washington Post, William Arkin, wrote a column about that at his blog today. His blog, I must say, is more like a daily column than it is a blog. You know, when I post things at my blog, you get little bursts of thought or observations wrapped around an excerpt from a news story. He writes full-blown columns, and I really appreciate his point of view, although I don't always agree with his political perspective. I think he treads a little too close to the Democratic Party line for my taste, but he does offer some insights that you don't usually hear from the other talking heads and the rest of the mainstream media. Arkin pointed out that the exercise that was undertaken as part of this continuity of government drill involved a North Korean missile, perhaps under the guise of a nation or group called the Universal Adversary. You know, they always give them code names so that they can't be accused of targeting a specific nation or country or terror group or ethnic group or anything like that. But universal adversary was apparently in this exercise preparing to launch a or detonate a 10 kiloton nuclear device somewhere on the United States. The other point that Arkin brings up in his piece today, which we should sit up and take notice of, is that a couple of members of the Defense Department under Bill Clinton published an article today, an op-ed piece, in which they suggest that we should preempt, the North Korean missile test. And these were not lightweights in the Clinton administration either. We're talking about his Secretary of Defense, William Perry, and Ashton Carter, who was an Undersecretary of Defense. They basically write that we should destroy the missile where it sits in North Korea. Now, while I can see that when you're dealing with a man of questionable stability like Kim Jong-il, that might not be a bad idea. We do well to remember that Kim Jong-il usually doesn't go any further than the amount of leash that's let out from Beijing. He is essentially their attack dog, used to test the waters to see how we will respond and how effectively we will respond to a perceived threat. So whatever Kim Jong-il is doing, it is our belief, and I think there are many who would agree with us on this, that it is with the blessing, if not the and if not at the direction of the Chinese government. And an attack on North Korea would likely not be looked well upon by China. The other thing we have to think about is this. While, again, while I'm not inclined to feel very comfortable about Kim Jong-il with nuclear weapons, the odds are that he probably already has them. And that we missed an opportunity to stop him in the years gone by. In fact, the Clinton administration probably didn't help matters any by promising him, you know, to help build nuclear reactors if he just give up using the enriched uranium from the reactors for weapons. But what Clinton or what Perry and Carter are proposing is that we would destroy the missile on its launch pad, full of fuel. It's likely to go up like a Roman candle. And to tell the North Koreans that we're only interested in destroying the missile, you should not interpret the attack on the missile as an attack on your country, okay? Like we would respond in a similar fashion. I mean, here we are. We're saying that you can't even have the missile. You can't even put fuel in the missile because we interpret that as a belligerent act. However, we have the right to blow up your missile on your soil, but don't take it personally. Well, it will be interesting to see what happens. And by interesting, I don't mean fun interesting. I mean that this is a delicate situation. And there are layers, I'm sure, going on, layers of maneuvering going on that we don't see on the surface. But again, I suspect that the hand of Beijing is at work in what Kim Jong-il is doing. A story that hits kind of close to home for us here in the bunker, broken by Salon.com yesterday, it's been revealed that a network operations center for AT&T just north of us here in suburban Bridgeton, Missouri, or rather suburban St. Louis. Bridgeton is the name of the suburb. It's just northwest of downtown St. Louis. AT&T has maintained a secret, highly secured room for the last 4 years where government work of some sort is being conducted. Now, it's not certain what is being done, but former AT&T workers who asked to remain anonymous indicated to Salon that only government officials or high-ranking AT&T employees with top-secret security clearance were admitted to the room. The room's security includes a biometric man trap, a double door secured with retinal and fingerprint scanners. This is spy stuff, okay? This is Hollywood movie stuff. These former workers told Salon that their supervisors told them that the employees in the room were only monitoring network traffic and that the room was being used by a government agency. Now, security experts contacted by the author of the piece for Salon, Kim Zetter, told her that it had all the earmarks of an operation run by the National Security Agency. This would fit with what is being divulged in the press over the last few months of AT&T's willing cooperation with the NSA. And with what we talked about last night with the new privacy policy announced by AT&T, which is basically that all your base are belong to us. All of your information belongs to us, and we can do with it whatever we want to. And if you want to continue using AT&T's services, you will agree to this. In fact, not only will we track, not only will we make your information available to the government whenever they ask us, we're going to track what movies you watch through our movie service. Well, it appears this has been going on right here in our backyard for some time, possibly. It's not confirmed, but these former workers do say that the high level of security around this room and the fact that a government agency was working inside this room at AT&T's Bridgeton office just outside St. Louis would indicate that someone in the government, and very probably the NSA, has been listening into all of our conversations or conversations routed through AT&T servers and network backbone for the last 4 years. Bear in mind that Southwestern Bell, before changing its name to SBC a couple of years ago and then again changing its name to AT&T just recently, was based out of St. Louis. This was a, you know, basically the center of their operations. So this is a very interesting story, and it's another piece to that puzzle that is slowly emerging of exactly how closely the big telecoms have been cooperating with the NSA in listening in on the conversations of average Americans. Don't you feel safer? Let's add one more piece to this puzzle. Do you think this has anything to do with AT&T's lobbying of the Congress and the federal government to allow AT&T and other backbone internet backbone providers to charge companies like Google and Yahoo more to get their content delivered at a faster rate than small-time internet operators? Do you think that maybe AT&T has been quietly cooperating with the government in order to lay the groundwork for this sort of takeover, basically, of the internet? We're just asking. Looking to the Middle East, because there's always something going on over there, Chicago Tribune is reporting today that Air Force Colonel Robert Boyles, testifying to Congress on Wednesday, said that apparently human trafficking operations have been set up on American military bases in Iraq, paid for, with tax money from you and I. Kellogg Brown and Root, KBR, is doing an awful lot of work in Iraq, not least of which, of course, is that 104-acre palace that's being erected on the banks of the Tigris River to house our new embassy. It's being called by the people in Baghdad George W.'s Palace. And, since it's roughly the same size as the Vatican, it's probably an apt description. KBR, for security reasons, is not using Iraqi workers on this project and on a number of other projects at military bases. Instead, their subcontractors are trafficking Asian laborers in from poor nations in South Asian nations and countries in the Asian Pacific. What they'll do is when they get these workers onto Iraqi soil, these contractors will confiscate the passports of these Asians who come into country to work, which basically leaves them stranded and at the mercy of the contractors who promised them high-paying jobs to get them there. As of now, there are an estimated 35,000 foreign workers in Iraq working on U.S. bases for more than 200 subcontractors hired by KBR, which, as you know, is a subsidiary of Dick Cheney's former company, Halliburton. So what we've got here, even though the headline in today's Tribune was a little less purple in its prose, is a human trafficking operation being run by the subcontractors who are being paid in American dollars, collected from American taxpayers, by Dick Cheney's former company, Halliburton. Colonel Boyles is working on military reforms aimed at eliminating the practice of trafficking in Asian laborers in Iraq. But again, there are 35,000 of them that are in country right now, and they're paid for with the money that you and I sent in on April 15th. The news from Iraq in terms of the overall situation may not be as rosy as you are hearing from Washington, D.C. Former U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage told The Australian, which is a newspaper based in Australia, of course, that, things look so bad there that the Iraqi government may soon ask the United States to just leave. Now, considering that there are thousands of people who have been killed this year in Baghdad alone, mostly in sectarian violence, Shia on Sunni, Sunni on Shia, and even in the south, in Basra, the area controlled by the Brits, where the violence is Shia on Shia. Armitage was quoted as saying the British used to make a big deal of walking around in their berets in the south. Now, they won't even go to the latrines without their helmets. It's not an optimistic scenario. He said the best case following a U.S. withdrawal would be that Iraq would become a loose federation with a weak central government. This is what we think the plan has been all along. We think the plan all along has been to split Iraq into several zones loosely based on tribal or ethnic ethnic boundaries. The Kurds in the north, a middle section that is primarily Sunni, and then a southern area bordering on Iran that would be mostly Shia. All of this about establishing a national government is, we think, wishful thinking, because you're dealing with tribal divisions and religious divisions between the Sunnis and Shias in particular that go back hundreds, if not thousands, of years. And to expect them to put all of that aside in the interest of democracy, in quoting Marx, is naive at best. Now, since we don't happen to think that the men who run things are naive, we suspect that this has been the plan all along. I mean, let's face it, as easy it is for us sitting out here in the middle of America, in red state America, to look at Washington, D.C. and say, those guys are idiots. Look at what's happened to the price of gasoline. Look at what's happened to the price of a barrel of oil. Look at the mess that we're entangled in Iraq. It's taken longer than expected to set up a government. There are shootings and killings taking place in that country every day. Many people suspect that much of the violence is being carried out by official government agencies, the Department of the Interior or the Interior Ministry in Iraq. It would be, I think, foolish to believe that the government of the United States is run by men who got there by being stupid, by accident, and that the multinational corporations, which have their fingers in the Iraqi pie, like Halliburton, KBR, the multinational oil companies, and the security contracting firms, are there because they're foolish or stupid. Thus, if we step back, reevaluate, and look at the situation with a different set of filters on, and say, you know, maybe this is the way they wanted it all along, to keep the country divided up so that it is not able to establish a strong central government, which might be able to, say, nationalize the oil industry. That this may be exactly what was wanted. It is interesting, though, to hear from Mr. Armitage in public, someone who was intimately connected with this process, that the Iraqi government may, in fact, just ask us to get out soon. That is interesting. We look at Iraq's neighbor, Iran, as things continue to move closer toward a confrontation. And in the United States Congress, the Democrat leaders in the U.S. Senate have introduced the Iran Intelligence Oversight Act. Apparently, they are cheesed about being left out of the loop when it comes to U.S. intelligence on Iran. So they are holding hearings now, or want to hold hearings, conducting their own briefings with experts who are called in to give their assessment of the situation, but they're doing so as outsiders looking in from the outside without access to the intelligence that the White House has. Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid said that Congress has not even been briefed on the offer that was made to Iran to help Iran overcome some nuclear technologies, or some difficulties, rather, that they were having with nuclear technologies if they abandoned plans to enrich uranium. Reid said the Iranians have been briefed, the Europeans have been briefed, the Russians have been briefed, the Chinese have been briefed, but not the United States Senate. Now, that statement would carry more weight with me if the Congress, the Senate, and the House were actually exercising its authority under the Constitution of the United States to serve as a check on the power of the executive branch, the president and his administration. But after going public with this complaint that the executive branch is not briefing Congress as it should, and introducing this plan, this act on Monday, actually, the Iran Intelligence Oversight Act, the Senate then turned around and voted by an 86-13 margin to reject a proposal to require the administration to withdraw all combat troops from Iraq by July 1st, 2007. And then minutes later, the Senate voted 60-39 to reject a non-binding resolution to urge the administration to begin withdrawing troops. Now, with a 60-39 vote, and understanding that the Senate is nearly evenly split between Republicans and Democrats, there were a number of Democrats who crossed the party line and voted with the Republicans to even reject the idea of asking the president with a non-binding resolution, pretty please, can we start bringing home some of our troops? Now that's courage. That is courage. Thank you, Senator Reid. I salute you. Well, other interesting doings going on in Washington, D.C. The investigations and revelations surrounding disgraced lobbyist Jack Abramoff continue to send repercussions through the Republican Party. Yeah, I sound like a real flame-spewing Democrat today, don't I? Which is so far from the truth, because I think in the last two election cycles, I can only think of one Democratic candidate for office for whom I voted, and that's the Attorney General here in the state of Missouri. I haven't voted for a Democrat at the national level in since 96. Oh, and well, like I said, this is the radical middle, too socially conservative to support Democrats at the national level, and yet just really insulted that the Republicans, once they were given the opportunity, showed their true colors as globalists and money-grubbing, power-hungry, professional politicians, just like I thought the Democrats were coming into the 2000 election. Anyway, Jack Abramoff and information that's come out because of Abramoff's troubles and trials before the legal community is implicating some real movers and shakers inside the Republican Party in things that are not quite according to Hoyle. Grover Norquist, who is the president of a lobbying group called Americans for Tax Reform, you see him interviewed on the news from time to time. He is a very powerful man within the Republican Party and thus in Washington, D.C. right now. There are emails now that are coming to light dating back to 2002, which show Norquist asking for money from Indian tribes, clients of Jack Abramoff. What is interesting about that, about Grover Norquist and his connection to Abramoff and his dealings as a lobbyist and fundraiser for the Republican Party, is information that's sort of been bubbling under the mainstream media's radar for quite a while. We mentioned Paul Sperry, former Washington bureau chief for WorldNet Daily and author of a couple of books out there that we recommend. Have not read his new one, but Infiltration, but if it's as good as Crude Politics, it's worth getting. In fact, I plan to order it. In the book Infiltration, Paul Sperry outlines the way in which radical elements, radical Islamist elements, are wielding influence inside the United States, inside the political framework of Washington, D.C., on both sides of the political aisle, as though there were only two political parties in the United States. Grover Norquist, several years ago, founded an organization called the Islamic Free Market Institute. This was in 1998. This organization has a stated purpose of cultivating Muslim Americans and Arab Americans who believe in conservative family values. Leading up to the election in 2000, Norquist and other Republicans thought it would be a good idea to cultivate this group to try to make some inroads into that community, which had voted primarily Democratic in the previous two elections. Now, one of the movers and shakers who helped Norquist found this Free Market Institute, or the Islamic Institute as it's better known, was a gentleman named Abdurrahman Alamoudi, who wrote a couple of personal checks, a $10,000 loan and what appears to be a $10,000 gift to help found the Islamic Institute. In addition, Alamoudi made payments in 2000 and in 2001 after the president, after George Bush was elected president, totaling $50,000 to a lobbying firm with which Norquist was associated at the time. In addition, Sperry points out in his book Infiltration that Norquist has married a Muslim woman. This was in April of last year, named Sama Al-Rayez. Now, it's worth remembering that according to Islamic law, Muslim women cannot, absolutely cannot, marry a man who is not himself a Muslim. Okay? This is the kind of thing, this is the kind of thing that prompts honor killings in some parts of the Islamic world. So this is a serious deal. Now, what that says about Norquist and his sympathies regarding the Islamic faith and how he wields that influence through his connections inside the Republican Party is open to question. This is an area of which Dave Emery, in his program, For the Record, has done a lot of work. He's done a number of programs on Grover Norquist. I have not listened to them all. I will just say this in summing up, that Grover Norquist, according to Paul Sperry and according to the research that Dave Emery has done and summarized on his program, For the Record, that Norquist is an agent of influence for Islamists inside Washington. Interesting, then, that he was soliciting funds and apparently receiving them from Jack Abramoff, who is an Orthodox Jew. Okay? Don't have time to go into that any further. I would, however, recommend Dave Emery's program for more information on Grover Norquist, and we are going to get a hold of Paul Sperry at some point to talk to him about Infiltration. Strange bedfellows you find in politics, no? One final story. I'm going to rant a little bit more about the Episcopal Church USA. An article from the Times of London has a very interesting opening line as it describes the events that took place at the recently completed convention for the ECUSA. And I quote, "The Episcopal Church in America descended into chaos last night after leading bishops on both the liberal and conservative wings disassociated themselves from a last gasp effort to avert a schism with the worldwide Anglican Communion," end quote. So the Episcopal Church USA has elected a primate, a woman, a female, doctor, I'm sorry, not doctor, but bishop, I had her name highlighted right here, forgive me, it's Kathleen Shorey, Right Reverend Catherine Shorey, I should say, is the new presiding bishop over the Episcopal Church USA. Hours later, the delegates at the convention agreed to exercise restraint in appointing any more gay bishops, any more homosexual bishops. However, immediately after that vote was taken, a group of 30 liberal bishops issued a statement of their own saying that they would not abide by the new resolution. Bishop John Chain of Washington, who presides over the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., said that he would not agree to block the ordination of any homosexual bishop. I should point out, Bishop Chain is the gentleman who preached a Christmas message a couple of years ago in which he said flat out that Jews, Muslims, and Christians worship the same God. He also said that the angel Gabriel appeared to Moses, to Muhammad, and to Mary. And I'm not sure what translation of the Bible Bishop Chain reads, but I don't see anywhere in the Bible where Gabriel appeared to Moses. That's just me. I'm not a bishop, so maybe I'm you know, nuts, but maybe he's got access to a better translation than I do. I don't know. Five conservative bishops in the ECUSA accused the General Convention of misleading the rest of the Anglican Communion by sending a false message that they intended to comply with the recommendations of the Windsor Report. That's the sense of the rest of the Anglican Communion, which is basically trying to rein in the Episcopal Church USA. And so we shall see, but it appears on the surface anyway that the Episcopal Church USA is about to fracture and likely find itself kicked out of the Anglican Communion by the more conservative members from Africa and Asia. Well, we've got the third part of a fascinating interview that we have been conducting with author Jerry E. Smith. There is an array of radio antennas in Alaska, which is designed to pump 3.6 million watts of power into the upper atmosphere. Why? We're not quite sure. It appears when you go to the DARPA website, that's the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, when you go to their website and read between the lines, it appears that HAARP is designed to weaponize the atmosphere. We go now to the third and final part of our interview with author Jerry E. Smith.
Peering into Darkness, PID Radio continues, and our guest Jerry E. Smith, the author of HAARP, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, rejoins us. Sharon had to step away for this segment as the dogs have awoken from their nap and need to be entertained in order to keep them quiet. But Jerry, welcome back. Want to get into an area that you cover in some detail in your book, the possibility that this antenna array and high-frequency radio waves might actually be used for something other than just heating the atmosphere.
Righto. Mind control.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're unfamiliar with mind control, it sounds completely preposterous.
Right.
And the more you know about mind control, the more, my gosh, it sounds. The more serious and believable it sounds. I've been studying mind control since Walter Boart and I met in 1976 when Walter was on the tour with his book Operation Mind Control. You know, that is an amazing book. You can't get it now, and the CIA really objected to it, to the point where the CIA bought the publishing company to get the plates, to destroy the plates, and recalled every copy they could and destroyed every copy they could get their hands on.
Wow.
Yeah. Talk about free speech in America. So, the aspects of mind control really that hit me was, again, I heard about HAARP I was a researcher working with Jim Keith. In fact, Jim Keith and I shared a pen name, and we were trying to create a fiction factory, and that didn't really fly. Our fiction, it's very hard to sell fiction, and we got into nonfiction, and Jim first, me after, got real that built our careers on nonfiction, but we had Jim put together a circle of researchers to help him pull his books together.
Mm-hmm.
And some of our researchers, you know, listened to Art Bell, heard Nick Begich on Art Bell, got the book, and so there was a lot of buzz about in 1995, 96. There was a tremendous amount of buzz about HAARP. It was the hottest thing on the internet. And what hit me was Begich had pointed out that one of the primary purposes for the project. The reason the United States Senate had funded the project was to engage in something called earth-penetrating tomography, which is something like CAT scanning the Earth, and it's done by using extremely low-frequency radio waves which penetrate deep into the Earth, and if you have the right equipment, the right guys in the right place, you can read what's underground. And the United States Senate funded HARP to target and monitor enemy underground bases for the manufacture and launch of weapons of mass destruction.
Mm.
And the Navy got in on the project because they had the problem of communicating with deeply submerged submarines. And they realized that if you can get ELF or VLF, extremely low frequency, very low frequency radio waves, to do earth penetrating tomography, which penetrate deep into the Earth, you can also use these same waves, which go deep into the sea, to talk to deeply submerged submarines.
Mm-hmm.
So the Navy and the Air Force have been jointly running this thing more or less since day one in order to do this. And what hit me was the ELF that they plan to use to communicate with deeply submerged submarines or monitor enemy underground bases was at exactly the same frequency that the human brain worked at.
Interesting.
And I realized that if HARP was exactly what it said it was, if there's no black ops whatsoever, it's just completely open and above board, and they're doing exactly what they're saying, they could wreak havoc on humans across the planet and have no clue they're doing it. There are no biological scientists on the project. Everybody on the project either knows about the ionosphere or about radio. They have no clue about how these things affect humans. And we know that the human brain is a radio transceiver, that the human brain is affected by external signals, and that you can change human consciousness by beaming the right signal at it. You can make people double over in pain or fall down laughing.
Mm-hmm.
These frequencies are known, and HARP is designed to bathe the world in these frequencies. And it struck me that if these guys had no clue what they were doing, they could easily create mental dysfunction or road rage across half the planet and have no idea that they were doing it. And if they did know what they were doing, this could be the ultimate mind control device.
Hmm. And of course, the more disturbing aspect is that they really do know what they're doing.
I spend a good 40 pages on the history of mind control to establish that at least some portions of the government do indeed know what they're doing, and that this is the logical next step in where they have been. You know, a lot of people are unfamiliar. A lot of people just simply don't know or don't want to know. The U.S. has been involved in mind control for a very long time. You know, mm-hmm. we've heard about the Manchurian Candidate and those evil North Koreans brainwashing our boys during the Korean War.
Right.
But our guys had actually been at it first,
mm-hmm.
and when they found out what the North Koreans were doing, they went, wow, that's cool. Mm-hmm. How can we do that?
Well, we interviewed author Peter Levenda about that very topic a couple of months back, and it was a very eye-opening interview.
Yeah. So the CIA had many projects, one of which was MKUltra.
Mm-hmm.
MK is the German spelling for mind control, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
MKUltra was 149 separate sub-projects that ran for over 20 years. And as well as MKUltra, there was also MKNaomi, MKArtichoke, MKDelta, and half a dozen others.
Yeah, Bluebird and others, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So there's a bunch of stuff here. And another aspect of this that I want to get to is you mentioned Bluebird, and that rang a bell. Bluebeam. Are you familiar with Project Bluebeam?
No, actually, I'm not.
Project Bluebeam may be a hoax. It may be in the same category of things as the protocols of the Elders of Zion or silent weapons for quiet wars, or whatever, however that goes, quiet weapons for silent wars, that's it, both of which are spurious documents that purport to reveal an inner secret.
Mm-hmm.
sometime about 20 years ago, a document got smuggled out of NASA that revealed a game plan that NASA had, and they were just waiting for the technology to come up to be able to do it. And this is Operation Bluebeam, and the purported technology they're using, the purpose of this thing is to create a world government, a new world order, by faking either an alien invasion or a rapture.
By having
the god of each region appear in the sky and put into people's heads the emotions of rapture, of delirious delight, and the words, "I am here, the time has come, the prophecies are fulfilled, we are going to have a new world religion of me and my deputy who's going to run the earth for me, and he is David Rockefeller."
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there's there has been a great deal of debate as to, you know, whether this thing is real and how they can do it, and are the technologies actually being developed. And when I went a couple of weeks before I sent the manuscript for my book Harp, the Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, off to the publisher I sent it off in February of 96, and in January, late in January 96, CNN Worldwide News announced, I was sitting there working on something, and this news blip comes up, and the CNN talking head announces that there has been a press conference at which the Secretary of the Air Force had just announced that they have perfected battlefield holographic projectors for terrorizing, frightening, disorienting enemy troops.
That's very interesting.
And we've been talking this last couple of days about how HARP has been under the guidance of DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, for the last since 2002.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been going over the list of things that they say they've done with it. And the last thing they say they've done with it is right on the mark for this. The generation of optical and infrared emissions in space to calibrate space sensors.
The generating optical
and infrared emissions in space.
In space.
For calibrating space sensors.
Right, of course. But but when you do that, essentially what you're doing then is generating an image or light or something
exactly,
in the sky.
Painting the sky.
Yeah.
Which means they're right on that's on the mark. If Bluebeam is real, we're in trouble. They are actually moving closer to being able to fake the rapture.
That's very interesting, because not only the rapture, but there was a story that came out of Jerusalem within the last 2 years of a group there that felt that they could fulfill the requirement of rebuilding the temple on the site of the Dome of the Rock without having to eliminate the mosque by simply creating a holographic image of a rebuilt Solomon's Temple over the Dome of the Rock.
Wow. Wow.
So,
that's a wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's an aspect of mind control.
Yes.
Yes. Herding the sheep is, one of the great questions about HARP that we talked about yesterday was weather control.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you can covertly control the weather, you can force enemy governments to do your bidding.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can directly talk to their subjects, if you can directly put stuff into their heads, you've won the game. You know, you don't have to mess with the weather. You don't have to blow anything up. You don't have to knock anything down if you can just take over the people.
Now, am I wrong? I think I remember reading, and forgive me for not having the information at hand, but that the technology exists now to beam sounds into the heads of subjects by...
Right.
Is that done by radio waves, by a tightly focused sonic beam, or what?
I actually cover that at some length in the book. It's called Voice to Skull.
Okay.
And if you look up, if you do a Google on Voice to Skull, you will actually find it is a phrase used in military circles, in military documents. So they are working on Voice to Skull. I have materials, publicly available scientific papers from the 1970s, because when I wrote the book in 96, that's as recent as they had declassified.
Mm-hmm.
And I had several pieces of voice-to-skull technology working. I think I give two or three in the book. After the book came out, I found six more patents for technologies that do put words into people's heads without having to have anything connected to the person.
Hmm.
And now, in the last few years, there's been a tremendous uptick in interest in mind modems, in direct human-computer interface. Now, right now, they're still using wires. I got a story, I think from CNN, yesterday or the day before, about a conference, a scientific trade show in Europe, where a scientist wearing a bunch of sensors on his head had a gizmo that read his brain waves and could interpret his brain waves and type on his computer. And so there was a photo of this big monitor, display screen of what's going on his computer monitor, and it's saying, good afternoon, gentlemen. My thoughts are being typed onto this screen for you.
Hmm.
And, that's just the start of it. They have been trying to get machines to read minds since the 60s, and they're getting awfully close to it.
Now, of course, reading thoughts is one thing, but projecting thoughts into someone's head is something else again.
It's not that dissimilar, because it's all brainwaves.
Mm-hmm.
And once you figure out the right brainwaves, once you figure out the signal, initially, you're right, they're picking up our signals and translating them, but it's not, as I was saying, there are at least six different technologies of voice-to-skull patented in the U.S. now, which means there must be a whole lot more being played with in laboratories.
Mm-hmm.
So being able to send messages, being able to have cell phones without cell phones is just a couple of years away.
Yeah. Now, what frequency does the human brain operate at?
Between 12 and 40 hertz.
Okay. And what frequency does the does HARP generate up into the atmosphere?
Again, HARP on the field of antennas on the ground is in the high frequency range, which is like 9 to 12,000 hertz.
Okay, all right.
And then that injects this energy into the ionosphere and heats the ionosphere. The HARP is a type of device called an ionospheric heater.
Mm-hmm.
And by heating the ionosphere by several thousand degrees, you blow the molecules apart.
Mm-hmm.
And by blowing the molecules apart, that generates a scream of ELF, extremely low frequency, which is down around 4 hertz, 6 hertz, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
The initial plan was to turn the Aurora into a virtual antenna,
mm-hmm.
tens of thousands of miles long, to take the electrojet, which is flow of electrons from outer space to Earth, and turn it into a virtual antenna to be able to transmit across the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
The University of Alaska guys were very excited about the idea that they could use this virtual antenna to open thousands of new channels for TV and radio in the Arctic zone.
Hmm. And then by broadcasting in this ELF spectrum, then they would be broadcasting, as you say, in the same spectrum as the human mind.
Exactly. And I'm not sure, but I suspect most mammals' minds are roughly the same area,
mm-hmm.
Only a little lower than ours. So there's a lot of potential for environmental havoc here that has never been adequately addressed.
Have you seen any indication that either the University of Alaska or DARPA is aware of this, or is taking steps to protect against unintended consequences?
Nope.
Hmm.
Nope. Again, there are no biological scientists involved in the project. Nobody who actually is working on HARP has any sort of biology under their belts. They're all the University of Alaska guys are all either know about antennas or know about the ionosphere. The project manager at DARPA, Dr. Sheldon Meth, when he took over HAARP, he was running three other projects at the time, two laser projects called Air Laser and Laser Star, and some kind of a bomb called the magneto-hydrodynamic munition, whose initials are Mayhem. So this guy had Laser Star, Air Laser, HAARP, and Mayhem, and his assigned task.
Yeah, well, either one of these things is not like the others, or they're all alike. So this is what our guys are working on. What are the counterparts to DARPA in Russia and China working on? Do you have any idea?
I really don't. I get bits and pieces of things. Mostly what I get is the commercially available is what mainstream sciences are working on. And there's, you know, there all of these things. Science has a big problem in that there seems to be this, if we can do it, if it's at all possible, even wildly possible, let's just go ahead and do it, regardless of the consequences.
Hmm.
And I point out in my book, HAARP, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, that there are a lot of potential consequences that we don't find out about for a very long time after we've fooled with something. My best example is the Rome invented this brand new technology, indoor plumbing, and they thought indoor plumbing was just incredible. It was a wonderful new invention, mm-hmm. and everybody who could afford it got indoor plumbing, and then they went mad from lead poisoning because
right.
they did not know the downside of the technology, that if you use lead pipes, you get lead poisoning and go crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so this is the sort of thing we're working on right now. We are madly developing vast, incredible, strange technologies, and we have no clue what the downsides are going to be.
Well, Jerry, this time has gone by far too quickly, and we certainly look forward to talking with you again when your next book, Weather Warfare, The Military's Plan to Draft Mother Nature, is complete. But so as not to leave people hanging, where do people find out more about what you're working on and how to order your book?
My website is jerryesmith.com. That's a good place. My publisher's website, adventuresunlimitedpress.com, is a good place. I will be doing things on my website constantly to update as we get closer to the release of the book. Right now, I'm still writing Weather Warfare. Oddly enough, you can buy it at Amazon.com now. I wouldn't recommend doing that. They have as a release date in September, and I think that's a bit optimistic. You can go out and buy it now, and if you don't mind us having your money for 4 or 5 months, I encourage you to do so.
But HAARP, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, is available now, and you can get that through Amazon as well as at your website?
At my website, at my publisher's website, at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, barnesandnoble.com. You can get it at any major bookstore. If they don't have it in stock, ask them to order it. It usually arrives within 3 days, and that's good for me. If you order it from your local bookstore, they may decide to order more.
Absolutely. Well, Jerry Smith, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Again, the time has gone much too quickly. We look forward to doing it again.
HAARP, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, published by Adventures Unlimited Press. Author Jerry E. Smith, and his website again, jerryesmith.com. Tomorrow, Sharon may be back. Not certain yet. Again, it depends on whether she's able to scout out a suitable location for the new and improved bunker. We'll find out. If not, well, you'll be stuck with me again tomorrow night. And again, we just want to stress that while we cannot be certain of what our schedule is going to allow us to do over the next few weeks, we will do everything in our power to continue the broadcast schedule as faithfully as we can. Besides, we've already got a number of interviews in the can, and we don't want them to go to waste. We certainly want you to hear the things that Peter Lavenda has to say about Nazis and the occult, and that will be our interview next week. Tomorrow and Sunday, we have interviews coming up, which we'll conduct with Eric John Phelps. He's going to talk about the John F. Kennedy assassination and the connections to the Jesuit order. The brothers Philip and Paul Collins have a new and revised edition of their book, The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship, and we will have them here on Sunday to discuss that. Their interview will be coming up in just a couple of weeks. So even though there may be a modified, possibly restricted schedule for PID Radio over the next few weeks, we'll give you as much lead time as we can, and we certainly will continue to bring you the interviews that we've got already scheduled and already recorded over the next few weeks. And it is our intent, had a couple of emails asking today, it is certainly our intent to continue to do this to the best of our ability once we get relocated and settled into Columbia, Missouri. It's just that until we're there and we are actually settled, have the new internet access set up, and all of the other logistics that need to be taken care of when you transfer from one place to another, we just don't know how much time we're going to have. But we do appreciate your kind words, and we do recognize that some of you folks have made it very plain that that you really appreciate what we do, and that is very humbling, and we don't take that lightly. So again, we will certainly make it one of our priorities to do this to the best of our ability. So meanwhile, we want to remind you that the super colossal tinfoil hat contest is continuing. Yes, your opportunity to become one of the Illuminati. Aluminum foil hat in the following three categories: funny, original, and high tech. And we will be selecting winners at the end of July in each of those three categories for your choice of a PID Radio t-shirt or mug to enjoy with your Krispy Kreme donuts while you sit in your very own air-conditioned bunker. Now, we've not tested the t-shirts to see if they are taser or bulletproof, but we're working on that, and we'll see if we can come up with a t-shirt design that at least offers some measure of protection from the forces of the New World Order. Your comments, your questions are welcome. We always have our ears open for interesting guests or news items that we might have missed for WatcherMagazine.com. Our email address is radio@peeringintodarkness.com. And our forum is always open for your discussion of the things that we talk about here on PID Radio, or other items that you catch in the news, things that catch your attention, or just things you feel you need to get off your chest. The forum is open at peeringintodarkness.com/forum. Tomorrow night, we'll sort of wrap up the news events of the week, either solo or, God willing, if Sharon is back with the other half of my brain back here in the bunker where it belongs. Until tomorrow, I'm Derek Gilbert. Thank you for listening to PID Radio. This is PID Radio.